Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host of the show. And today I'm thrilled to welcome Melanie O'Brien. Melanie is Associate Professor of International Law at the University of Western Australia and President of the International Association of Genocide Scholars. And her new book, published in November 2022 by Routledge, is titled From Discrimination to Death, Genocide Processed Through a Human Rights Lens. Melanie, thanks for joining us and welcome to the New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we always start the same way. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you decided on academics and law and how you became interested in mass violence?
Well, this is a great question, and I fell accidentally into academia on the way. I became interested in this topic area back in high school, and in high school I studied about the Holocaust, I studied about the history of modern day China, and it was these kinds of studies that led me to be really interested in this idea. I think I got intrigued by wondering how people could do this to other people. It was this underlying question. And I was also, I think, strangely motivated by, you know, as I was growing up, films I watched. I was really obsessed with the film Dances with Wolves. Mm. And revisiting that film, you know, I realize it's really a very strong commentary on colonialism and injustice that came with colonialism. And I really loved that movie. And I also honestly loved films like Footloose, which is also about, you know, unjust and arbitrary rules and people standing up against them. So I think this was kind of in my blood, and I would write high school assignments about environmental issues like saving the baby fur seals and things like that. So I think I was always interested in it from being quite young. And then I went into university and I studied history and law. And when I studied history, I studied the Vietnam War, I studied the Holocaust, nationalism, fascism, these kinds of things. So I was following this same interest area that I had started in high school. And I always wanted to be a lawyer. That was the only thing I ever wanted to be. And I was always interested in criminal law. And when you put together history and criminal law, you get international criminal law. And when you put together this sentiment that I had about justice and standing up against arbitrary rules, you get human rights law. Mm-hmm. So that was how I ended up specializing in these two areas of law. And as I went through, obviously, when you're interested in areas like human rights law, you want to work for organizations, whether it be intergovernmental organizations like the UN or non-governmental organizations. And that was always my goal. But it can be very difficult to get a job in those fields. So I ended up doing a PhD after I'd done my master's in international human rights law. And then I just fell into academia because that was the job I got after doing my PhD. And so it wasn't my intended career, but as someone who loves research and is passionate about research, you know, I'm quite happy to be here, although there's always a part of me that is still wishing to be a practicing lawyer. So I'm admitted as a lawyer, but I don't practice as a lawyer. And so I think there's always that niggling part, because when you're a lawyer and that's kind of what you want to do and it's part of you. But you know, I love research, so you know, I'm still very happy with where I am and the work that I get to do, especially in the sense of the work that I do and working with survivors a lot, means that essentially I am working with the vulnerable and in a different way, helping them and helping their voice get out there.
So genocide studies is a pretty interdisciplinary field, and I'm always intrigued to hear people's perspectives and the way their discipline shapes their approach. So what do you think, having been trained in law, how does that shape the way you approach the study of mass atrocity violence?
I think it's really interesting thinking about the different disciplines in genocide studies. And obviously, I'm a lawyer. I come from a law background. I do also have a degree in history as well. But I've always been very socio-legal, meaning that I don't just think about the law on the page. I think about that the law is made by people. How does that influence the law? But also, the law impacts people, all of us, every day. You know, many people don't think about that, but the law is relevant to everyone every day. And that's the most important part about law, is not just what's written on the paper, but how will what's written on the paper impact people in their daily lives, essentially. So I think that makes... That can make me look at law a little bit differently, because when we think about international criminal law, a lot of the lawyers are what we would call doctrinal. So doctrinal is when you are just looking at, you know, what is the law, essentially, you know, looking at the law on the paper. And that's fine, and it's really important, and we need people to be doing that. So that's no criticism at all. But I think I have learned a lot from being part of the genocide scholars community, from other disciplines, a huge amount. And that's drawn into my work as well. So I consider my work to be predominantly law, but it's also interdisciplinary. I bring in other areas of other scholars, sociology, history, politics, anthropology, and so on. You know, there's so many fields in genocide studies, and they really inform my work and I think make it better. And I think what lawyers can bring, legal scholars can bring to the genocide studies field, is this deeper understanding of the law, what it is and how it's applied and how it affects people, which is really important to know. But I think that working with the other disciplines in genocide studies means that it enables me to be a more creative lawyer. Rather than just thinking very strictly about things, it enables me to think, to look at other perspectives about genocide and think, how could we incorporate that into legal understanding of genocide while still using the definition that we have? So how can we be flexible enough to bring in new ideas but still within the parameters of this definition that we have?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'll have to kind of reflect on that. I will say to listeners, I pointed out in the introduction that Melanie is serving as president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars. We're not going to talk about that specifically here today, but I will point you to an interview Melanie did with Caleb Zakarin, several months ago, that is also on the New Books Network. And you can find that wherever you get your podcasts or on the website. But for here, your new book is titled From Discrimination to Death, Genocide Processed Through a Human Rights Lens. And I wonder, why this book? What made you decide that this was a question you wanted to spend, as we talked about before the interview started, several years of your life thinking about and working on? Why this book?
Actually, it started back in, I think it was around 2012. And I went to Sydney. I was working in Brisbane at the time, and I flew to Sydney to do an interview with the Gandel Foundation, which is a philanthropic organization based in Australia. They're based in Melbourne. And they run an amazing program through Yad Vashem, which is a Holocaust educators program. And I went to Sydney to do an interview to be part of this program. And they said in the interview, we would really love you to be part of the program and bring in your human rights expertise with thinking about the Holocaust. So obviously it was focused on the Holocaust, and I was successful, and I took part in that educators program, which was in part a little bit online, but then we spent time in Israel at Yad Vashem in this really amazing educators program that they run. And as part of that, as my project for that, I created a teaching unit on genocide and human rights. And it really got that, it really started from there. And I became interested in thinking about what is this connection between genocide and human rights. And then I ended up applying. I was in the first sort of 8 years of my career, I was in what we call precarious employment, meaning I had fixed term contracts, which obviously, you know, is an ongoing problem for people in academia. But one of the advantages that I had with that is that these were research positions, and I was very privileged to be able to have these research positions. And I ended up in a 3-year research fellowship at the University of Queensland, and that was for this project. So I applied with the proposal to undertake this research in looking at this intersection between genocide and human rights. So I was able to spend that 3-year fellowship doing field work and starting to write the book.
So let's turn to the book. And for some of our listeners who are deeply enmeshed in this subject, the question may not be necessary, but a bunch of our listeners, I suspect, come from different perspectives. So how are you defining human rights in this book, and where do they come from?
So human rights are basic freedoms and protections that belong to everybody. That's the essential basic definition. And what I use in this book is I draw from the international human rights legal system that exists. So I draw from treaties, so human rights conventions that exist, for example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, or the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. So those are only two examples. There is quite a large system of international human rights law. So I draw from different treaties. I also draw from the case law that has come about in international courts, and also from the international human rights bodies at the United Nations. So each of the human rights treaties has its own body that's attached to it, its own committee. And what they do is they oversee implementation of the treaty that they're assigned to. But they also, some of them are able to hear individual complaints from individuals in countries that are a party to that convention. And so in doing so, they will issue a decision about that complaint, and part of that is about interpreting that particular right that's at issue. They also issue, really importantly, documents called general comments on each of the different rights that you find within a treaty. So they are an important source of interpretation of each right and understanding the parameters of that right. And they're part of what we call in international law, soft law. Mm. So treaties are what we would call hard law, and they can be binding, and the soft law is not necessarily binding. So, but they are still really important because they're our way of understanding, you know, when you look at a treaty provision, it's quite short. So, you know, it might say freedom of expression, but you need to what is freedom of expression? What does that mean? What are the parameters of it? So these types of documents are actually really important. So those are the types of sources that I have drawn from in looking at my definitions of human rights. And what I do in the book is each chapter looks at a specific right or group of related rights. And at the beginning of the chapter, I talk through that right. I define that right. And I say, here's what we're looking at, before I then look at the case studies and say, okay, how was this right violated in those case studies? So we need to understand what the right is before we see how it was violated.
So how genocide studies scholars and scholarship, how have they addressed questions of human rights in the past?
One of the things I found when I started looking at this topic was that you see this expression genocide and human rights pop up every now and then. It's even in book titles, it's in book chapter titles. And then you read the book or the book chapter and there's no mention of human rights at all in the document, you know, in the book or the chapter. So I thought, oh, this is strange. And of course, most genocide scholars are not lawyers. Yeah. So why would they know about the human rights law system? Because that's not their field of expertise. So I thought that this would be a great opportunity to connect non-law genocide scholars with the human rights legal system, but, you know, not in a general sense, but in the sense of which parts of it are relevant to genocide and specific to genocide that they would need to know about.
The Genocide Convention is not a human rights treaty, it is a crime suppression treaty obliging states to criminalize genocide. So how did this happen and why is it important?
This is often a misconception where the Genocide Convention is referred to as a human rights treaty, but it's actually not. The human rights treaties are completely different. So the ones, for example, that I mentioned, like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights or the one on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, you also have the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, you have rights of persons with disabilities. They are very different instruments. Mm. They have a different structure and they have a different function. And they also have, as I've mentioned, committees that are tasked with overseeing their implementation and sometimes can hear individual complaints from people against their own countries if their countries have violated their obligations under that treaty. So it's very, very different. And they are about rights, as I said, basic freedoms and protections. Whereas the Genocide Convention is a crime suppression treaty. So we do have other types of crime suppression treaties as well. A lot of them come out of, for example, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. So it's that kind of angle. For example, treaties about that talk about human trafficking are actually saying, you know, you have to criminalize this as well. So the Genocide Convention is not about rights of individuals, but it's about the obligation of the state parties to that convention, so the countries that are a party to the convention, criminalizing and punishing and preventing genocide. So that's what the obligation is here. That's why it's a crime suppression treaty instead. And the Genocide Convention grew out of, we don't have time to go into it today, but it came out of the work of Raphael Lemkin. And, you know, there's a lot of great work, a lot of literature that's been written about that, that listeners could have a look at, such as Doug Irvin Erickson's work or Donnelly Fraser's work. So there's plenty of literature out there about the creation of it through the leadership of Polish jurist Raphael Lemkin. That's the difference between these, you know, how they're implemented, but also the actual obligations on states are different.
So, and just a reminder to listeners, if you're interested in that, I did an interview with Donnelly Fraser several years ago now, when her edited work of Lemkin's. So go back in the archives for that. One of the things you argue then is that genocide is a process, but you understand, and that's at the core of your book, I think, at least one of the things that's at the core. Can you say what you mean by that and talk about how human rights plays into it?
Genocide as a process, it pops up in genocide scholarship. There are other scholars that have come up with their own methods, you know, their own theories of the process and how it works. But I think one thing that genocide scholars agree on is that genocide is not an event. It's not a one-off moment. It is a process. And essentially, What I argue, and what other scholars who have talked about process argue, but what I hope comes through very strongly in this book is that you can't get to the killing phase without all of the other actions that happened before it. What genocidal regimes have to do is all of this groundwork to make the killing become acceptable to the majority population so that they can carry out the killings. The killing is only part of the goal of genocidal regimes, of the perpetrators, but they can't get there without everything else. So they have to build up this perception of the targeted group, the minority group, that ultimately dehumanizes that group in the eyes of the majority population so that all of the discrimination, all of the persecution, and ultimately the physical violence that takes place becomes acceptable. And therefore the majority population stands back and watches it happen or even participates in it, making it possible to take place. So it's not just the killing, it is all of that. That is part of the process. And my argument in this book is not that what you see through the book is the lead up to genocide. My argument is that it is genocide. It's part of the genocide process. And that's really important because one of the other things that I argue is that often what we see when genocide is prosecuted in courts is the focus on killing. So individuals are prosecuted for killing people as part of genocide. But in fact, every example in this book, every chapter where I look at a particular human rights violations, I also point out where would this fit in under genocidal crimes? So you could actually prosecute all of the instances that I describe in this book. And my goal is to hopefully encourage prosecutors to prosecute and judges to convict for the other crimes in the genocide process because they're also really important. We have this focus on the killing, but when you look at the impact that some of the things have in this book, so for example, when I'm talking about taking away people's housing and people's financial capacity, so genocidal regimes do that. They evict people from their houses, they take away their property, they take away their property rights, as in, you know, they take away their titles to their property. So people don't even have the paperwork. They can, you know, if they survive genocide, they can't go back and claim back their housing because there is no way for them to do it. But also what happens is if they do manage to flee to safety, they have no money, they have no property, they have no way of establishing a new life somewhere else without a huge amount of difficulty because they simply have no money, no property because it's been taken from them. And that's becomes an ongoing problem. So all of this is, you know, if you think about that, that's you, yes, you've probably also lost family. And so, and I talk about the very long-term and lifelong issues with that. But the other things are also important that when you reach a safe country, you don't have the money to rent a house. You are struggling to find employment. All of these types of things do have really significant impact on the survivors, the victims of genocide, and so also need to be taken into account and taken seriously when these crimes are prosecuted or in any way brought to court.
I'm thinking of a number of people, but Scott Strauss comes to mind, political scientists who are trying to create a kind of theory of genocide or theory of mass atrocity violence. And Strauss in particular talks about null cases, about societies where many of the rights that you talk about are violated, but somehow they never manage to make it to the killing. And he uses that in terms of asking us to recognize that moving through this process completely is not inevitable. I wonder how you'd respond to that kind of way of thinking about theories and how that fits your argument about human rights and genocide.
It's a huge challenge to look at negative cases. Mm-hmm. You know, I think scholars who look at it, they acknowledge that at the same time. Like, how do you really know why this violence didn't progress further, or why this situation didn't progress into violence, and so on? You know, some other scholars like Stephen McLaughlin have looked at dictatorship and the leadership style, and tried to understand how leadership style has led to negative violence cases. So it is a real challenge to look at that. But one of the things that I argue in this book is saying, okay, if we look at this pattern, we know we're in the genocide process. And so what I say is that we should be using the human rights legal system, so these human rights treaty bodies, these committees that I was talking about, using them to actually step up and take action. And then, of course, other UN bodies as well. But as a starting point, those treaty bodies looking at the situation and saying, hang on, we're actually, there's this pattern happening here, and this is a genocide pattern. So we should take action to prevent it from going any further, for progressing through the process to the high level violence, things like torture and killing. So yeah, my argument is we should use this for a midstream prevention tool. But obviously, the other thing I do want to say is that I'm not arguing that every single genocide will look like this or has to look like this, mm-hmm. but just that if you see this pattern, it is a genocide process pattern. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's very difficult to say why would it stop, but I think it comes down to, you know, and leadership is obviously quite important, but it comes down to thinking about human rights, like how are human rights perceived? Because a human rights culture definitely contributes to preventing genocide. So if you see a culture that is bringing back human rights, so talking about this, you know, if you sort of get halfway through the process, you know, it's escalating to a certain point, but perhaps it's also societal as well. You know, it's not sitting well with that particular society and that particular culture that this is progressing through. So yeah, it's really difficult to say the reasons, but ultimately, you know, what I will always advocate for is a human rights culture in a country, the culture which is implemented through a legal system as well. That's really important, that individuals have the ability within their domestic legal system to stand up for their own rights when they've been violated. That's really important. So I'm not just talking about the UN legal system. I'm talking about what individual countries do in how they implement rights, but how they allow their own citizens to stand up for their rights and to take action when their rights have been violated. And it's quite, you know, actually in Australia, we do not have a human rights charter at all. So I see that in my own country as being a significant issue, that people don't have recourse, except in very specific circumstances. So, for example, we have a Racial Discrimination Act, we have a Sex Discrimination Act, but those are very, very narrow. But when we think more broadly about rights, there's no charter here. And many countries in the world don't have such a charter. And these are so important for people, for the individual, to be able to make sure that their rights are upheld in their own country, and so that we don't progress to a situation like genocide.
You used a term that some people might not be familiar with, so I just want to put a pin in it. We'll come back to this idea of midstream interventions, or but just a little bit more kind of background on the book. You kind of identify, you broadly identify five separate stages of human rights violations. Can you talk us through those five stages briefly?
Now, the five stages that I identify is essentially the escalation of the process. And I don't want to say that this is strictly linear, because many of these overlap, but it is an approximate temporal timeline of the rights violations that occur through the process in the approximate order that they occur. So I start, part one simply focuses on freedom of discrimination. And as an example, that may be where it starts, but I also very clearly state that this is overarching throughout the entire process, because all of the rights that are violated throughout the process are with the exception of freedom of expression and opinion, which is violated from the entire population, but all of the rights are focused on violating those rights of the targeted population, so it's discriminatory. So that's why I keep that one separate. Part two is where we look at essentially the lower end, and we say lower end, but again, I want to emphasize that we can't get to the killing without these, so they are still really important. So I look at freedom of expression and opinion, education and culture rights, employment, political and fair trial rights, freedom of religion, family and privacy rights, and child rights. So how I would position these is to say that these are non-violent, in a sense, non-physically violent anyway. So this is before we reach the more extreme physical violence part of the process. And to me, really, here at this stage, once we see these specific rights being violated, here is where we could argue we need to take action before it escalates into part three, the next stage, where now we start to see restrictions on freedom of movement, liberty and security of person, and we also start to see slavery coming in. Here is where I also start to address the rights to health and adequate standard of living, which is plays quite a significant role in the genocide process. And when we start to see those rights really being violated, that's when we move into part four, the next stage, where we look at the right to freedom from torture and, of course, the right to life. And so that's the main process. But actually, I add an additional stage to my theory, and that is the refugee stage, which I think is a very unique way to look at it, where I argue, and I know we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I argue that the refugee stage also forms part of the genocide process and should be considered overall when we're talking about the crime.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
We don't have time to talk about all of these. And so I just want to encourage the listeners now to pause the podcast, go order the book, and then come back. But maybe a couple of them, maybe you can give us a little more detailed sense of what you're doing and what kind of rights are being violated. And you talked a little bit about discrimination already. So maybe we'll move to family and privacy rights. So what kind of rights get included under this broad label of family and privacy rights? And how does that fit into this notion of human rights violations as a part of the genocidal process?
So family rights, I put family and privacy rights together because they are connected in the human rights law, but they're also connected in practice as well. I also want to point out that I also talk about family rights in the chapter on child rights, but I separate those discussions because children do have additional specific rights to being a child, but that are connected to family rights. I think one of the most important things that comes out of looking at family rights, you know, the right to a family, just essentially, is that one thing that just comes through: every single survivor in every genocide you look at has lost family members. And maybe if they're lucky, they've only lost one family member, but so many people have lost just huge numbers of their family. Sometimes they're the only surviving member left of their family. And this is just, I mean, it's incredibly significant. It impacts them for the rest of their lives. You know, they experience the mental health issues that go with family loss for the rest of their life. This sense, things like a sense of loneliness. And I think one of the stories that really struck me in thinking about family rights, I actually talk about in my refugee chapter, but it's very much connected to family rights. Saw Hai Gov, the story of a Cambodian refugee who was a child under the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s and lost his parents and his siblings. And he eventually managed to find some of his family, two of his two uncles, and neither of them wanted him. They argued over, I don't want him, I don't want, you know. They saw him as simply a burden. He was another mouth that they had to feed. He did end up going with one of his uncles to Australia as a refugee. So you think, okay, he's lost some of his family, but he's managed to find some family. Like, isn't that great? But in fact, he had a terrible life living with his uncle, who just saw him as a burden, who abused him, who made him work as what that was seen as payment for having saved him and brought him to Australia. So he was a child. He was 13 when they came to Australia, and he was made to work to pay off this debt and constantly abused. His cousins would be playing and he would have to work. So he didn't have a childhood. And you can argue that even though technically he was living with family, he didn't have a family. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't able to essentially be safe until he became an adult and left that home and created a life for himself. So you can see that this right to family can be quite pervasive as it goes through, even if it's not necessarily about the family that has been killed. Mm. So it's quite significant. And there's also the issue of separation. So it's not just about death of family members, but there are so many stories of survivors who they assume that their family members have died, but many, many years later, you know, we're talking about like a dozen years, even 20 years and decades later, they actually find their family. And some of them often never really reconnect with their family. You know, I give the example of a survivor who found her father who had moved to Argentina, and the cultural divide between them was so great because she had grown up somewhere else that they never really reconnected as father and daughter. So even without death in the family, there can still be a loss of family. When I talk about privacy rights, because obviously this is probably something that people don't think about. So people might think about family as being something obvious, but privacy rights are really different. So privacy can be about bodily, intellectual, spatial, decisional, communicational, associational, proprietary, behavioural, and informational privacy. So it's actually quite a broad concept. But even when you think about the basic elements of privacy, you think about something like when people get put in ghettos and camps and they live in very crowded conditions. There's that idea of physical privacy that just does not exist for people. I also talk about the use of nudity in genocide and the privacy element of that. The use of nudity pops up a few times throughout my book in different ways, but it's also obviously a violation of privacy rights. That's, you know, it's our bodily privacy. Mm-hmm. Thinking about bodily autonomy and the control that the perpetrators have over victims. So this is a violation of their right to privacy, and nudity is often used specifically by perpetrators. You know, and people talked about, for example, victims of the Holocaust talking about when they went to camps and were put into the showers, they talked about how it was the first time that all the family members had seen each other naked, because that was not something that they did. And so they were very embarrassed by having to do that. So there's all these things that we think about as being smaller, but really have quite an impact. And the survivors are still talking about these aspects of what happened to them years later. It still impacts them. So it's not unimportant, you know, these aspects. So I thought that this, the privacy rights, was quite an interesting one to explore.
Yeah, and all of these chapters are interesting. I was particularly there were several of them more like the family section or privacy or especially children's, where looking at it from a human rights perspective made me think anew about the lenses we bring to the study, and very rewarding to read them. You've suggested this a couple times, but in particular, I was intrigued by this notion of genocide continuing. And so this issue of refugee rights as being and the experience of refugees as being part of that genocide process. So can maybe explain and expand on that?
I'm glad that this intrigued you, because this is one of the aspects I'm most excited about to present in this book, because I think it's unique and other people have not considered this part of the genocide process. So what I look at here, so there is a refugee convention from 1951, and I'm not looking at refugee rights from the refugee convention. What I'm looking at in this chapter instead is how do refugees experience human rights in general? And so I look at some of the rights that I've explored in the book. So rights like employment and rights like religion and culture and political rights, family and child rights, adequate standard of living and health, and even, you know, looking at things like freedom from torture and the right to life as well. So looking at their experience, what I'm essentially arguing, because I found that, so there are different way, different experiences of refugees. What we often know, we know that when there's a genocide, there is going to be a mass flow of people across the border into a safe country next door, because they have to get out of the territory where they're at risk of being killed or put into camps, whichever stage we're at. I mean, people start fleeing the country from early in the process. So we're not talking about people just fleeing the country when there's killing happening. They start to flee the country early in the process, which again is another argument for genocide being a process. But what they experience when you start looking at refugees' experiences is really difficult. And when we think about, like, now we have a refugee system from the convention, we have the UN High Commissioner on Refugees, we have the International Organization for Migration. So we have these organizations that are there to help refugees when they cross the border. But regardless of any of their best efforts, you can't suddenly provide food, shelter, clothing, medical assistance for thousands, sometimes millions of people who are crossing the border all at once. If you think about the Rohingya in 2017, it was in the space of a month that you had close to a million refugees crossing into Bangladesh. So it is just not logistically possible to suddenly provide medical assistance, food, shelter, and so on for all of these people. So they always end up in these horrific conditions, no sanitation. They're already starving. They're already injured, likely, because they've walked a lot, very long distance. They could have experienced violence before they left, and they have injuries from that. So they're already unwell. They're already starving. They may be ill as well. And they get there and there's no food and there's no shelter. There's no clothing and there's no medical assistance. So what we see is people facing illness from things like cholera, dysentery, these kinds of transmissible diseases that happen when we have no sanitation, and people die from these. And they can die from the injuries or the illness that they already had and couldn't get medical treatment from. We see lack of security. We see girls and women experiencing sexual violence in high numbers in these kinds of camps. So actually, it's inevitable that the genocide process continues through what I argue are the genocide crimes of causing serious mental and bodily harm, but also imposing conditions of life designed to bring about death. And my argument is not that the host country is responsible, but that the original perpetrators are responsible for this conduct that occurs. And I also look at what happens to refugees when they end up in safe third states, like even when they're resettled, they have a very difficult time. They can't necessarily find employment. They really struggle to find housing. You know, I had a statistic in there that I found that even in 1990, so the Khmer Rouge were in power in the 1970s, but even in 1990, 40% of the Cambodian refugee population in the US was living in poverty. So, you know, it is very difficult for them. And they also have difficulty accessing medical and health assistance because of language barriers and cultural barriers. And they do have medical needs. They have medical needs from what they experience physically, but they also absolutely have mental health needs from what they experience. So these are the types of things that I argue are all part of the process and that those genocide perpetrators are responsible for. So I think that this argument will be really key for prosecutors to take to courts, but particularly where it's useful is the International Criminal Court, because the International Criminal Court only has jurisdiction over crimes committed within the territory of countries that are a party to the International Criminal Court. So what we often see, of course, is that crimes like genocide are committed in countries that aren't party to the International Criminal Court. But then what happens is the survivors have moved across the border into a country that is a party to the court. And so my argument is that we can then argue, well, part of the process happened in the territory of what we call a state party. And so therefore you can use that and you can actually bring charges against the perpetrators, even though they're in the next door country. So I want to say sneaky, but I think it's a clever legal argument. And I really hope that it will be taken up by the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. And of course, subsequently then the judges when they're making that decision.
So one of the things you say is that looking at this, at the genocide process through a human rights paradigm allows you to both retrospectively, but also looking forward from current events, better analyze mass violence and understand whether it fits into the genocide category of genocide or not. And you look specifically at the Rohingya as an example of how this might be done. So can you say a little bit about how you tried to do that and what conclusions you reached?
Yeah, so the main part of the book looks at three historical case studies, the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, and the Cambodian genocide. And it's about creating a theory. It's about looking at completed genocides to see, was there a pattern? Did that pattern have similarities between the case studies? Which the answer is yes, definitely. But then what I wanted to do was make this practical and look at a current situation and to say, does the current situation fit the pattern? So was there a point in this century where we could have stopped the violence of 2017 against the Rohingya or even 2012? And the answer is yes, because it also fits the pattern. Going back decades of discrimination and the specific discrimination of against the Rohingya by the Burmese authorities, decades of it. So action could have been taken well before what happened in 2017, where, well, the killing figures are unknown. It's estimated at least 10,000 people were killed, but, you know, as I said, essentially a million refugees ended up across the border in Bangladesh and are still there. So we could have, you know, the international community could have prevented this because they could have seen it coming, but for many decades. And so it was important to me to include something current because I wanted to say, here's how we can use this going forward in current and future situations, because even though it's a theory and I'm looking at historical cases, I want this to also be practical and to be able to be used in terms of human rights prevention, but also obviously prosecution, punishment of genocide.
I had a student a couple years ago who did her senior honors thesis looking at all, trying to understand what kind of information was known in the United States about what was happening to the Rohingya in the years before the ethnic cleansing, expulsion, whatever term we want to use. And she came up with dozens of reports from a variety of nonprofit organizations outlining clearly the kind of human rights violations you were saying and making it impossible to think that impossible to think we couldn't know. And the tragedy, of course, is the space between those two cases. So then that brings us maybe back to that term you use, midstream intervention. And I think, although I'm not sure if somebody did it before that, but I think that's Jim Waller's invention. And I interviewed him about his book. Can you say a little bit about what midstream intervention is and how that intervention might work in this world?
I think that midstream intervention is not something we come across that frequently. What we see most is early warning, the early stages. And obviously, that's the most attractive because we would like to stop things even before they get to midstream. But I guess in arguing midstream, I'm just pr trying to present, well, I am presenting another option that if something wasn't stopped in the early stages, here we can see the pattern and we can stop it before it escalates. So using midstream is essentially looking at the process that I have found. And it fits with other process patterns, such as Helen finds, where we're thinking about detention, putting people in camps and things like that. But the midstream point for me is essentially where before we escalate to the physical violence stage of the genocide, and is stopping it there to try to prevent that, well, to hopefully to prevent that from happening. But that you can only see that we are definitely in a genocide process once you get essentially to that midstream point because the process is clearly there. So it's what I found was that because there are lots of human rights, there are more human rights than I cover in this book, but these are the specific ones that genocidaire, that the perpetrators actually really target to carry out genocide. And so, therefore, rather than sort of random human rights that might be violated that wouldn't lead to genocide, we have to be seeing, okay, here is this specific pattern. And we recognize now we are in the middle of the process.
So any good research project doesn't just answer questions, it raises them. So what, having done this, what does your research suggest about areas that you or other scholars might explore?
One of the things, I mean, obviously there are so many genocide case studies, and you can't cover all of them. Even doing three was a huge amount of work for this book. But one of the types of genocides that I do not look at here that I would like to see if this paradigm fits are Indigenous colonial settler genocides. So, as I've mentioned, my argument is not that every genocide must look like this. And so, therefore, I may look at those and find that this pattern doesn't fit them. It may do, but maybe it doesn't. That doesn't mean it wasn't genocide. I want to make very clear this is, again, this is not an argument that every genocide must look like this. It's just that if we do see this pattern, it is genocide. So I think that's a main gap in this. And I think I consciously made that decision because I felt like they are a genocide of a different ilk. And so I wanted to, but I think it was also based on the knowledge that I already had of these case studies. They were already on my radar. That's obviously, always how do you choose your case studies? And I did want to look at historical ones, but also it was ones that I had already had some knowledge of. So to build on that existing knowledge base as well. And so I think that's something that I would like to have a look at. But I really hope in the future that scholars will draw on this theory when they're thinking about when they're analyzing other case studies, whether they be historical case studies or current case studies. But we're talking about scholars, but I also really hope that policymakers are drawing on this and lawyers and judges when they're thinking about looking at current situations or when they're making decisions about prosecutions and what they will prosecute and how they will do it. And for judges, when they have to make a decision based on the evidence in front of them about whether or not it was genocide that took place, I hope they will think about this process and say, well, does the evidence show that it fits this process? Then yes, we can, this is was definitely genocide, and we can convict for genocide.
Here I am going to flip your role around and ask you, maybe somewhat informed by your role as president of this scholarly organization. I think we all wish as academics that our work would have that effect. I would love it if people read my stuff. How can this community of people, which spend so much of our time and effort trying to find ways of shaping a world that is better than the one we are in, how can we get the public to understand better the kind of conclusions we reach?
It's really challenging, isn't it? Because the work that we do is really important. We are working on something that is so significant and impacts so many people in such a terrible, terrible way. And all of us, regardless of the discipline or the angle that we take, our ultimate goal is the prevention and punishment of genocide through scholarly work. And a lot of us do advocacy work as well. And I, to be honest with you, I would consider all of scholars in genocide studies, even if all they're doing is writing journal articles and books, to be advocates, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand, how does genocide happen? How can we prevent it? How can we punish it? How can we educate about it? And we're obviously always hoping that our work will make a difference. And I think there's a few ways. For me, so as you will know, as an academic, there's this focus on impact. How do we prove impact? And it's a challenging concept, which so far nobody seems to be able to really define. But when you are a scientist, for example, maybe you are researching a cure for cancer and you come up with a cure for cancer, impact is very easy to prove. It is less so for scholars like us, for humanities and social science scholars. But for me, the biggest impact I have isn't something that is measurable. It's that I have the privilege of interviewing survivors of genocide, of mass atrocities, and I have that privilege of hearing their stories, which means so much to me, but it also means a lot to them, because it means a lot that someone is sitting and listening to them, that is willing to listen to them, and that believes their story, because many people don't. In Cambodia, people would tell me they've never told this story. One woman said, oh, my family doesn't believe me when I say what happened under the Khmer Rouge. So the catharsis for them is quite extraordinary. And that impact on me, I mean, how amazing is it to get to help people in that way? I think it's quite extraordinary. So for me, that's a really significant impact. And the fact that I'm a way that their voice and their story and their experience can reach a broader audience. You know, thinking about, say, the Rohingya woman in a camp in Bangladesh amongst a million other people, and I can take her story and put it out there so that people know what's going on. That's extraordinary. So then to take it to the next level, coming more back to your question and thinking about, you know, I think it's about networking. And that's one of the important things we try to do with the International Association of Genocide Scholars, is make sure we connect our scholars with practitioners. So we have a relationship with the UN Office of the Special Advisor on Genocide Prevention, which is quite important, and we have a policy paper series that office is engaged with and wants us to produce, because they want to read these things. The Special Advisor attends our conferences. For example, she will be a keynote at our conference this year, and they're always interested in what is the work coming out of the scholarship. So that's really important. And I think getting the chance to attend conferences where there are also representatives from organizations like the UN or courts, but also government representatives, is really important, and that scholars should not be afraid to give their work to those people. I was lucky enough to launch my book in December in Armenia, and it was launched by Silvia Fernandez, who is the former president of the International Criminal Court and the current president of the Assembly of State Parties of the International Criminal Court, and also by Mr. Nik Kumjian, who is the head of the Myanmar investigative mechanism. So these kinds of opportunities is making sure that your work gets into the hands of people who are actually practicing. So Mr. Krimjian is obviously in the process of collecting evidence about what has happened to the Rohingya and giving that to courts. So that's quite important. So I think using networks like IAGS for scholars is so important, and getting their work into the hands of the policymakers, the legal practitioners, those working in organisations on the field is a really important way of, you know, and we need to make sure we proactively do that, because of course a lot of our work that gets published in journals is behind a paywall that these people can't access. So it's important that we proactively send that out to these people, and in hope that the huge amount of work that we all put in does actually contribute in even the smallest way to genocide prevention and punishment.
Well, that seems an appropriate place to stop. So I always ask the same two questions at the end. The first one is, do you have a book suggestion or two for the audience? And as I told you before, I'm halfway through spring break, so maybe a book suggestion for me.
Absolutely. So I was thinking back about the time, you know, because it took me a long time to work on this book. There was a lot of field work. So I thought about, I went back to, as a nerd who reads, I make a list of all the books I read that aren't work related, although sometimes they are tangentially related. So I pulled out two of them that over the years that I was working on this book, I know I really enjoyed, like really found meaningful. So one of them is called Women of the Outback. And it's written by Sue Williams. And what it is, every chapter is the story of a different woman who lives and works in the Australian outback. And I found it extraordinary because I'm a real city woman. And so reading their stories and their lives and the challenges and the achievements and the different things that they do, from, you know, being a drover, you know, working on a farm with cattle, to running a pub. Of course, the pub is an essential item in every Australian town, and even especially in the outback, it's the centre, the no community centre. So, you know, these kinds of stories and the challenges that the women have faced was really extraordinary, and it's really easy to read. It's really well written in a very engaging style. And another one I read more recently is the book called The Watergate Girl by Jill Winebanks. So Jill Winebanks was the only female lawyer working on the Watergate case. Oh. And she's still a lawyer and still does, and has done a lot of amazing work since then. But this book is about her work, is about the Watergate case. And, you know, it's just fascinating because obviously it's such a fascinating case, and especially, you know, when we just had Trump as president, who had so many similarities to Nixon, going back and looking at things related to Watergate, it is really interesting. But also obviously hearing the story of what it was like for a woman working on that case, where she was the only woman, and how she experienced that, and, you know, the elements of sexism that she obviously experienced during that time, is really, yeah, really fascinating story as well. So those were two books that I enjoyed reading a lot. Stories of amazing and strong women.
I will look for those. Thank you so much. And the second question, which is always unfair, but always relevant for an academic, what are you working on next?
Oh, how long have we got? I am constantly working on issues related to the crime of forced marriage in atrocities, and I've been doing a lot on that over the past, it's probably at least 18 months now, because of the Dominic Ongwen case before the International Criminal Court. So I work in particular with Valerie Osterveld and Kathleen Maloney. On that case, we did there was a group of us, a group of women who submitted an amicus curiae brief. Amicus curiae, it means friends of the court. And we submitted that brief, and we also appeared before the court in the appeal of Dominic Ongwen. Mm-hmm. So that appeal has been issued, and amazingly, everything that we submitted was incorporated and upheld by the court. So that's really fantastic. And that's, you know, we were talking about impact. That's really extraordinary impact, and we're so delighted that we could contribute to justice for those victims who experienced really, really horrific crimes. So we're working on writing academic pieces out of that at the moment. Always have been working. Ukraine is always in the background as also a scholar of the laws of war, although I'm not writing anything on that at the moment. But what I am working on is last year I was lucky enough to be a research fellow at the Sydney Jewish Museum. And what I worked on there was an extension from my book, because I found that when I was writing my book, I couldn't say everything that I wanted to say, but also there were parts that I wanted to research more. So last year I was lucky enough to be research fellow at Sydney Jewish Museum, and I looked at the right to sanitation. So I interviewed survivors and I accessed, you know, all of their testimonies that they have and all of the amazing resources to look at how Holocaust survivors experienced sanitation. So it sounds weird. And there was a bit of, you know, there was always a bit of laughter around the office because Conrad Crete, who's the resident historian, and he's just wonderful, wonderful, supportive academic. He loved introducing me to people and telling them that I was working on shit. So, we laughed about it, but actually it was true because I was talking to the survivors about what was their experience with washing, what was their experiencing with toilets. And essentially cleanliness, that's what sanitation is about. And, you know, I've discovered it's really crucial in the genocide process because people die of lack of sanitation. They get diseases, they get infections. It can give them life, if they survive, it can give them lifelong health problems. So, you know, there's an element of there that we can make a joke about, but actually it's quite significant, and it's not something that people think about. So I'm looking forward to digging in now and being able to write up my findings from that research at the museum.
I've been talking with Melanie O'Brien, the author of From Discrimination to Death: Genocide Processed Through a Human Rights Lens, published by Routledge. Melanie, thank you so much for joining us. I hope that when you get that written up, you'll be back on the New Books Network to talk about it. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me and letting me talk about my book.